The content of the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic is for informational purposes only. The content is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified health provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition. Never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you have heard on the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare show. If you think you may have a medical emergency, call your doctor or 911 immediately. Focus on Females does not recommend or endorse any specific tests, physicians, products, procedures, opinions, or other information that may be mentioned on the radio show. Reliance on any information provided by Focus on Females or others appearing on the show at the invitation of Focus on Females is solely at your own risk. Now, it's time for the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic. Here, we create clarity out of confusion and guide you through today's healthcare maze. Each week, we'll focus on a different medical topic with a guest expert answering your questions. Future topics and guests can be seen at www.focusonfemales.com. Call in between 12:30 and 1 p.m. on Sundays and present your case to our experts. To get involved with today's clinic, call now in Hillsboro, 289-1860, and everywhere else, 877-969-8600. Be proactive with your health. We're here to focus on you. And now, our host, Dr. Stephen Maskin.
The Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic is on once again, and we thank you for listening. Today, we are tackling gastric ulcers and NSAIDs, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, with guest expert Dr. Jürgen Nord, a gastroenterologist from the University of South Florida College of Medicine. But first, this radio show and the free annual Focus on Females Women's Healthcare Symposium, now the largest in the country with 1,800 women, is supported by the not-for-profit Focus on Females Education Foundation, whose mission is to create an interactive, dynamic, community-based healthcare safety net, making you an expert on your personal medical needs. The result? Better partnering with your existing doctor, leading to more effective office visits, faster results, and a reduced economic burden of avoidable medical and emergency care. We save lives and protect families through the immediate impact of health education. And on that note of the Focus on Females Women's Healthcare Symposium, I'd like to encourage each of you listening today, whether it be here locally in the Tampa Bay area or streaming online if you're in the area or will be in the area of Florida in March, to register and attend the 5th annual Focus on Females Women's Healthcare Symposium, Saturday, March 27th. It will be at the Tampa Convention Center. And we have a great lineup of topics, 22 seminars in total, ranging from cardiac disease, colon cancer, cervical ovarian and uterine cancer, nutrition and cancer prevention, obesity in women, screening for breast cancer, migraines and headaches, fertility and family, menopause, bladder incontinence, osteoporosis, sleep disorders, breast cancer, reversing dry eye, heart care and disease prevention for women, skin cancer, diabetes, raising your child without going crazy, allergies and asthma, gynecological cancer, what you need to know, as well as looking more youthful without general anesthesia, and financial wellness. 22 seminars plus 8 fitness classes, yoga, Pilates, kickboxing, Tai Chi, stretching, Zumba aerobics, circuit training, and resistance training. And it is all free in addition to health screenings and wellness chair massages, all free. And please, to register, important to register online, go to focusonfemales.com. On that homepage, you can, on the upper right-hand corner is a registration tab. Left-click that tab, fill in the material, and you'll be have a seat reserved in the seminars that you wish to attend. Very important, and we look forward to seeing everybody there this year, and to break 2,000 women would be wonderful. Okay, well, let's get to today's topic, gastric ulcers. And first, I'd like to welcome my good friend, Dr. Jürgen Nord. Great to see you again, Jürgen.
Thank you very much, Stephen. It's a pleasure to be back here with you.
Dr. Nord is a native of Germany who received his medical degree magna cum laude from the Goethe University of Frankfurt, Germany. In 1965, he was awarded a Fulbright scholarship. He completed his residency in internal medicine at Indiana University Medical Center and his fellowship in gastroenterology at the Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri. In 1973, he moved to the University of South Florida College of Medicine in Tampa, where he is professor of medicine in the Division of Digestive Diseases and Nutrition, which he directed from 1990 to 2000. Dr. Nord is a past president of the American Society for Gastrointestinal Endoscopy, Florida Gastroenterologic Society, and Florida Society for Gastrointestinal Endoscopy. He serves on the editorial boards of several scientific journals. Dr. Nord has special interest in postgraduate education and has directed or co-directed 60 postgraduate courses. He has lectured at more than 630 local, regional, national, and international courses and scientific symposia, and has co-edited 3 books and manuals and more than 160 publications to his credit. Dr. Nord has been honored in the Best Doctors in America since 1996, and in 1998 he received the Laureate Award of the Florida Chapter of the American College of Physicians. The American College of Gastroenterology awarded him mastership in 2005. And in addition, you have done several shows here on the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic, for which we are very thankful.
Thank you.
So, now, and before we get started with the meat of the show, I want to remind everybody, now's the time to call in with your questions. We're talking about stomach ulcers, gastric ulcers, in relationship to NSAIDs, the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. If you have questions on gastric ulcers alone, that's a free game. Please call in with any questions related to that. The number here is 289-1860. That's 289-1860 for Hillsborough County. Everywhere else, it's toll-free, 877-969-8600. 877-969-8600. Now is the time to call in with your questions. So let's begin at the beginning, Jürgen. What is an NSAID, and how do we use it in our society? What are the most common indications?
Yeah, NSAIDs are some of the most commonly used medications. NSAID is an acronym, and it stands for non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. And what it means in a nutshell is that these drugs not only control pain, but they also control inflammation, and that's in contrast to, for instance, acetaminophen or Tylenol, which is only a pain medication but does not have an anti-inflammatory drug. So therefore, many patients with arthritis, fever, will use these NSAIDs regularly, and especially if you look at the aged population in the state of Florida, there would be a very wide use. Just a couple of numbers to toss out. For prescription drugs, about 111 million prescriptions are written per year, and that would be about $4.8 billion spent on prescriptions. If you look at the over-the-counter, and there are, by the way, 3 over-the-counter, and everybody will recognize those, ibuprofen, which would be Motrin and Advil, or Naprosyn, which is Naproxen, or Aleve, or Diclofenac, which is Voltaren. There are another 3 billion of those used, so that adds up to almost $8 billion per year. So it's a huge industry and widely used medications.
The 111 billion, that's just the NSAIDs?
111 million prescriptions for NSAIDs,
right? Per year.
That is correct.
Wow.
And those are data from 2004. I would expect that those data are higher for the present time.
Wow, amazing. Okay, and certainly those drugs are affecting many, many people. You mentioned that arthritis and the use of this drug for arthritis control as well as fever is quite common. And so obviously every drug that we take has some downside as well as upside potential. Would you like to speak to the potential risk involved in regard to the NSAID?
Yes, very much so. They're wonderful drugs, but clearly they have some potential side effects. And the reason that they have side effects is that they affect two enzyme systems in the body. One is called the cyclooxygenase one system, which is responsible for the normal function of the body. The other one controls the mediation of fever and infection. And if you block those enzymes, you can get into trouble. The most common problem that patients have that they get a belly ache. They think they have maybe an ulcer, but they might not have an ulcer. They might just have what we call dyspepsia or ulcer-like symptoms. And that happens in about 50% of patients if you take it regularly. Now, more serious complications are ulcers or complications of an ulcer, which would be bleeding or even an ulcer which would perforate, meaning you have a hole in the stomach. And that occurs in about 15 to 20% of patients that you have an ulcer, and about 6 to 8% who might have a duodenal ulcer, which is a small bowel ulcer just outside of the stomach. Right. Overall, patients who get in trouble are maybe only about 4%, and we now have some idea who these people are as compared to the total population that takes these drugs.
All right, let's come back to this. We do have a caller, and that's Jerry from Tampa. Jerry, welcome to the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic.
Thank you. For patients and doctors out there, there's an organism called H. pylori that has been in the literature for a number of years.
Right.
And the question is that particular organism still an issue, and should it be treated? I understand that maybe we should leave that organism alone and not treat it if you do find it. My understanding, it was responsible or there with about 90 to 100% of the ulcers that are diagnosed.
Jürgen?
Thank you for that question, Jerry. That's an excellent question. And indeed, Helicobacter pylori is still out there. It is less common in the younger population as compared to the generation of our parents and grandparents. And that has something to do with water hygiene, food hygiene, and so forth, because it's a waterborne infection acquired early in childhood. But if you look at the world population, it's still the most common infection in the world. About 60% are totally infected. You're absolutely correct that it is associated with ulcer disease, but not 100%, because many ulcers now, especially in the elderly, are not due to Helicobacter pylori, but they are due to NSAIDs. But Helicobacter pylori, if it is present in somebody who takes NSAID, is a cofactor. And therefore, if we have elderly or individuals who take NSAIDs on a regular basis, we should check for Helicobacter pylori. The next question is, should we treat it if we find it, or should we leave it alone? And there is a philosophy, and that is generally accepted in the medical community, called test and treat, meaning if you test for it and find it positive, you treat it. Otherwise, there is no reason to look for it. Why is that? Well, as I just said, it is a significant cofactor for ulcer disease. The World Health Organization also has classified it as a class 1 carcinogen, meaning on the basis of chronic inflammation, it ultimately in some individuals, certainly not all, but in some, can lead to stomach cancer. So we should find it. If we find it, we should treat it. And if individuals are treated, we should assure that it is effectively eradicated.
Now, how two follow-up questions. How can we be sure that it is effectively eradicated without doing a scope and a biopsy? What is the best test now for H. pylori? And can you do you still remain with the antibodies to it for lifetime? So how do you make sure you've eradicated it?
Again, thank you for those great questions. Number one, the antibody, which is a simple blood test, remains positive for life, and therefore it would not be a good test to check for eradication. Endoscopy, which is a common way to diagnose, certainly is a very invasive test, and we would like to avoid it. And so there are two other tests. One is a breath test, and the other additional one is a stool antigen, which is the most cost-effective. So most of us in the GI community now advocate the stool antigen test for Helicobacter pylori, and that should be tested about 4 weeks after completion of the therapy.
Is that possibly the best test to do on the way in the door, too, instead of a scope?
Certainly. I mean, if we would never use an endoscopy just to diagnose Helicobacter pylori. Many times there are other reasons to do the endoscopy, and or we might find an ulcer. Well, could it be Helicobacter pylori? And then we check for it. But certainly it would not be our first test. And therefore, you know, a stool antigen would be very valuable. A blood test is valuable as an initial test as well, especially if it's negative. If it's negative, no question, you do not have Helicobacter pylori. If it's positive, we can't be quite sure in some instances.
Thank you very much. And let me just say also that I heard your name on the air just now as I was driving. And I trained under you some 30 years ago, and I want to. There's only one Jürgen Nord, and I thank you for answering my question 30 years later again.
Thank you so very much. You are very kind.
Thank you.
So let me clarify perhaps one issue that some listeners may have may like to have clarified. If a person comes in complaining of symptoms which are compatible with upper GI, they may still need an endoscopy, a scope, prior to doing a stool antigen for H. pylori, correct? Just to sort out what's going on up there.
Exactly. You want to make sure, you know, there is no ulcer. You want to make sure there's nothing more serious, especially in elder individuals. And so certainly it would be appropriate. But like I said, about 50% of patients who take an NSAID will have stomach pain or a belly ache. The other complications are common, but certainly less frequent.
Okay, good. All right. And once again, our number here, before we go to a break, our number here is 289-1860, locally in Hillsborough County, Florida. Everywhere else, toll free, 877-969-8600. Be right back with more. Call in with your questions now.
This radio healthcare program is brought to you by the Focus on Females Education Foundation, a not-for-profit organization. Our mission is to make you an expert on your individual medical problems through dynamic and interactive educational programs. Real physicians answering real questions, speaking plain English, and giving practical, ready-to-use information on a wide variety of topics. Participation empowers families to better partner with their doctors. The result is more effective office visits, preventing unnecessary suffering, and eliminating the economic burdens of avoidable health and emergency care. We need your financial support. Donations to the foundation are tax deductible. Each and every dollar provides support so families can take control of their health. We have already saved and transformed lives for generations to come. Be a donor in what has been described as a phenomenon to reduce health illiteracy in our community. No donation is too small. To learn more about us and our free 5th Annual Women's Health Care Symposium, March 27, 2010, visit www.focusonfemales.com. Donations can be made to Focus on Females Education Foundation, P.O. Box 320702, Tampa, Florida 33679-2702. Thank you.
Do your eyes have a foreign body sensation or are scratchy and sandy? Do they burn, sting, or itch, or are heavy and tired? Maybe your eyes are sensitive to light or your eyelids achy and sore. Have you seen countless doctors and still can't find relief? Have they told you, sorry, but you'll have to live with this and nothing can be done for you? Well, first, it's likely you suffer from dry eye. And second, don't stand for those answers anymore. Just because someone else doesn't understand your dry eye problems, go to the only eye doctor in Central Florida that specializes exclusively in dry eye and related diseases. Meet with Dr. Stephen Maskin at the Dry Eye and Cornea Treatment Center, where you will be given up to 2 hours of face-to-face time with the doctor to get at the root cause of your dry eye pain, fluctuating vision, and redness, plus begin targeted therapy right away. Haven't you waited long enough?
Studio lines are open, so get focused, get involved, and get the advice you need for your health. In Hillsboro, 289-1860, and everywhere else, 877-969-8600. Once again, our host for the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic, Dr. Stephen Maskin.
And welcome back to the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic. We are discussing gastric ulcers and NSAIDs, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory agents such as aspirin, ibuprofen, Motrin, Advil, and the like. with my special guest expert, Dr. Jürgen Nord from the University of South Florida School of Medicine. And Jürgen, we talked a little bit about before the break about the role of H. pylori. So let's move back to the general topic of gastric ulcers. How do you stratify those patients who may benefit from gastroprotection and help prevent development of the ulcer?
It's a good point, Sim, because if you look at the magnitude of the issue, we obviously cannot offer and should not offer gastroprotection to everybody who takes it. But we now have some tools to identify those individuals at special risk for complications, and that would be at the top an individual who has had an ulcer or complicated ulcer, meaning an ulcer with bleeding or perforation before. That individual would be 13 to 14 times more likely to have the same problem again. The same would be an individual who takes multiple NSAIDs, and that would include even aspirin or low-dose aspirin. We can maybe elaborate on that later.
So even one baby aspirin a day is a significant amount of this medicine?
Absolutely. And later, maybe we can talk about cardiac risk and baby aspirin and who should not take it. But we say, well, baby aspirin, if it's good for a baby, how in the world could it hurt an adult? But now the name for that is actually low-dose adult aspirin as compared to baby aspirin. So, yes, that's another point. Individuals just being chronologically challenged or elderly over 60, 65 puts you at risk. If you take high doses of NSAIDs, and many times, you know, we take two of everything, take two and call me in the morning, the old story goes, so to speak. Clearly, that would be a risk. Or individuals have a toothache and two don't work and they take another two in 4 hours. They take 6, 8, 10 a day, puts them at a significant risk. Individuals who are on blood thinners or antiplatelet agents like Coumadin or Plavix, and individuals who are on corticosteroids.
All right, so let me ask a specific question here that our listeners may be wondering about. So is it your recommendation, if you need to take an NSAID for, say, arthritis, to try one pill, one NSAID, to see if that does the trick, rather than automatically taking two every time you reach for it?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, these drugs are very effective, and I think it's really the wrong policy to immediately start with two. Take one, look at the label, and then look at the appropriate interval when you should take the second pill. But to take two to start with, I think, is wrong because it puts you at a higher risk and may not necessarily give you more benefit.
Okay. And once again, our number here to call in with your question is 289-1860. That's in Hillsborough County, 289-1860. Outside of Hillsborough County is toll-free, 877-969-8600. Call now with your questions. Now, how about the buffered or enterocoded NSAIDs or aspirin? Are those considered safer on the stomach?
Yeah. I always say it kind of tongue-in-cheek. They help most those individuals who sell them. Indeed, they decrease some of the dyspeptic symptoms. But the effect on the lining of the stomach and the duodenum is a systemic effect. So it doesn't matter if you put it in the stomach, if you take it as a suppository, or if you get it intravenously. And therefore, the buffering really has no effect with reference to ulcer and ulcer complications.
Well, that's very important. So and even suppository, you said. Ibuprofen comes as a suppository. You're saying so the effect on the stomach is not a localized effect. It's a systemic after the absorption.
Correct.
So that pharmaceutical circles back to the stomach lining and affects that mucosa?
Yes. The mucosa has certain protective agents called prostaglandins, and the NSAIDs deplete the lining and therefore makes it much more susceptible to injury. And therefore, the enteric coating has no benefit whatsoever on those particular complication risks.
So it may decrease, I think you mentioned, it may decrease the dyspepsia or the irritation from the localized effect,
correct,
but it's not going to affect or not going to decrease the incidence of a frank ulceration of that lining.
Yeah, of the more serious complications. Absolutely correct.
Okay, good. How about the role of alcohol as a cofactor in the risk of ulcers with NSAID use?
Yeah, alcohol is also a risk factor, as Helicobacter pylori, as we discussed earlier. And if you combine an NSAID with alcohol or the other way around, let's say you would have a hangover and then take any of the ibuprofen, naproxen, or other over-the-counter preparations, it clearly increases the risk of bleeding to a significant degree. and increases and doubles or triples that risk.
Wow. Okay. How about taking the combination of NSAIDs and aspirin for cardiovascular procedures? Patients are, you know, on both oftentimes because of a cardiovascular concern. Does the combination increase the risk to the GI tract?
Yeah, the short answer is yes, it absolutely does. But let me back off. It's where two rights make a wrong. Let's say you take the NSAID because you are a weekend athlete and you're sore on Monday and you take the NSAIDs. You also believe that aspirin is good for cardiovascular protection. You don't know what your risk factors are, but you have heard it, and therefore you take it. And so the combination of the two clearly is what's called multiple NSAIDs and puts you at risk. And that is true even if you take the 81 milligrams. In Europe, it's 75 milligrams, 100 milligrams, and so forth. And it really takes only a very small amount of aspirin to block the platelet effect and make your blood less sticky. But let me make a point here. To the audience out there, how many of you know what your cardiovascular risk is, your risk of either a stroke or a myocardial infarction or an acute cardiovascular event? Most of you probably don't know. And therefore, you could easily go to Google and Google cardiovascular risk factors, and it requires only seven entries from age to blood pressure to cholesterol, bad cholesterol, and so forth, all in there, and it gives you that risk. And if your risk is low, you are going to be at a much higher risk to end up bleeding from your stomach as compared to helping yourself in preventing a cardiovascular event. So it's probably not a good philosophy for everybody to just, you know, take an aspirin because it might be a good thing for you.
Okay, well, that's a very good point. So what you're suggesting, one can go to Google and look up cardiovascular risk factor. They can certainly discuss this with their family practitioner. Some of the considerations, the variables, age, blood pressure, cholesterol. And if you're a low cardiovascular risk, what you're suggesting is if you take the aspirin or the NSAID to help to thin your blood, to help your heart, you actually may be causing more trouble vis-a-vis the stomach lining than the benefit you're getting from the heart if you are a low-risk person.
That's right. Let's say your risk over 5 years would be 1%, meaning 1 in 100 would have a myocardial infarction. You would prevent 1 to 4 MIs, but you would have 2 to 4 bleeds. If your risk is 5% over 5 years, you would prevent 6 to 20 myocardial infarctions and have only, again, 2 to 4 bleeds. So in that group, it would make sense, mm-hmm. but certainly not in the low-risk group. And that's why I think it's important to discuss it with your physician and see if this is indeed a smart policy.
Very good. Let's talk about the effect of NSAIDs on other parts of the intestinal tract. Does it impact the upper intestine, small intestine, for example?
Yeah, we always thought that these drugs, except for the well-known effects on the stomach, were quite safe. That's probably not the case. We now know that they can cause lesions in the small intestine as well, and as we now have these capsule endoscopies, these instruments that kind of tumble down through the intestinal tract and take pictures, we know they can cause ulcers and bleeding in the intestine as well. They will certainly affect renal blood flow, and therefore, especially again for elderly who might have some renal impairment as well, very important that you drink adequate amounts of fluid if you take NSAIDs on a regular basis. And everybody remembers when Vioxx was taken off the market. Vioxx was a selective NSAID similar to the Celebrex, which is still on the market. And obviously there were cardiac problems. The studies at that time didn't have placebo arms in it, and now we know that indeed the regular NSAIDs may be suspect as well, and actually the companies were mandated to do studies with reference to cardiovascular risk of those NSAIDs. We don't have the answer yet. We'll have it in a few years. So again, you know, take minimal amounts, take it for the shortest period of time, and certainly consult with your physicians. They may not be cardiovascular safe.
Okay, and I want to make one point on as you describe the effect of NSAIDs on other areas of the body. You mentioned the small intestine, yes, but also renal blood flow, which of course for some people the renal is kidney, so it affects the kidney blood flow. It can decrease the blood flow to the kidney, and
yes.
And it could also affect the renal collecting tubules.
Yes. And again, it's mediated systemically through the prostaglandins, which are important for the stomach as well. Prostaglandins are important for appropriate renal blood flow. So if you take it in high doses for a long period of time, if you might have some mild renal impairment, it might make it worse. So again, you should know what your kidney function is, should be checked at least once a year, and you should drink adequate amounts of liquids. Steve, may I make one point just to maybe put in perspective the scope of the problem? If you ask me, you know, how many people in this country, in the United States, are hospitalized per year, number would be more than 100,000. To put that in perspective, there would be Tampa Stadium totally filled, every seat, and then one-third stadium as well. If you then ask me how many patients die in this country every year, that would be about 16,000 individuals, and that is very similar to all individuals who die from HIV/AIDS. Mm-hmm. So it's a big problem. You might ask, how can a drug being over-the-counter, readily available without a prescription, have risk factors to this degree? Of course, many of those are related to taking the drugs inappropriately, and therefore, please read the label. There's a lot of fine print on it, and it's there for a very good reason.
And any doubt, ask your family doctor.
Yes, indeed.
And tell me about gastritis. And we try to make a differential between gastritis and gastric ulcer. Does gastric ulcer begin with the gastritis?
No, not necessarily. The gastric ulcer related to Helicobacter pylori starts with gastritis, and gastritis is a diffuse inflammation of the lining of the stomach. The NSAID ulcers have very little, if any, gastritis, and they are very localized. We don't know why not the entire stomach ulcerates and only a certain part. It's probably related to mucosal blood flow and to other factors there as well, but it is not related to gastritis.
Okay, good to know. Can an NSAID cause gastritis with a local effect?
Yes, very good point. Let's say I take an aspirin pill and put it right there and leave it on that stomach lining. It can, because aspirin is called salicylic acid, so it's a weak acid, and it has not only a systemic effect, but it can have a local effect as well. And yes, indeed, it can do that.
So this dyspepsia, 50% of people with taking this dyspepsia, that could be from an element of gastritis.
Yes, it could be, and from local irritation. And actually, in 1 out of 10%, it is bad enough that patients have to stop the drug.
So interestingly, an anti-inflammatory drug can actually cause inflammation.
True. The other thing is, most patients, if they get in trouble within the first 3 months or so. If they have been on it for a long period of time and do well, it's rather rare. Furthermore, many patients come in and all of a sudden they have a black stool, which would suggest intestinal bleeding, or they throw up blood, and many of those patients have no symptoms before. The reason for that being that indeed the NSAIDs are good pain modulators, and therefore they don't get the typical pains. All of a sudden something serious happens without any warning, kind of lightning out of the blue sky.
That's an interesting point. So the NSAIDs can almost like control the pain gate.
Yeah.
So to speak, can downregulate it so that but nevertheless, you can break through that. At that point, it could be a serious problem.
Yeah. I mentioned at the beginning the 50% people with dyspepsia and pain. These patients usually don't have any ulcers when you look. Many times, those that come in with the ulcer pain has been blunted by the NSAID, but the other complication has not, and so they come really without any symptoms. First episode, bleeding and throwing up blood.
Okay. All right, we're going to take a quick break and be back with more. Once again, our phone numbers to call in with your questions, call right now. In Hillsborough County, 289-1860. That's 289-1860. Elsewhere, toll free, 877-969-8600. 877-969-8600. We're talking about stomach ulcers. Call right now with your questions.
This radio healthcare program is brought to you by the Focus on Females Education Foundation, a not-for-profit organization. Our mission is to make you an expert on your individual medical problems through dynamic and interactive educational programs. Real physicians answering real questions, speaking plain English, and giving practical, ready-to-use information on a wide variety of topics. Participation empowers families to better partner with their doctors. The result is more effective office visits, preventing unnecessary suffering, and eliminating the economic burdens of avoidable health and emergency care. We need your financial support. Donations to the foundation are tax deductible. Each and every dollar provides support so families can take control of their health. We have already saved and transformed lives for generations to come. Be a donor in what has been described as a phenomenon to reduce health illiteracy in our community. No donation is too small. To learn more about us and our free 5th Annual Women's Healthcare Symposium, March 27, 2010, visit www.focusonfemales.com. Donations can be made to Focus on Females Education Foundation, P.O. Box 320702, Tampa, Florida 33679-2702. Thank you. Your host for the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic is ophthalmologist and eye surgeon, Dr. Stephen L. Maskin. Dr. Maskin is the medical director of the Dry Eye and Cornea Treatment Center, the proud sponsor of today's show. At the Dry Eye and Cornea Treatment Center, Dr. Maskin specializes in solving difficult dry eye and cornea disorders with patients traveling from over 35 states and 5 continents for his evaluation. Dr. Maskin manages these dry eye disorders using innovative medical and surgical therapies, including the use of placenta-derived amniotic membrane, a new patent-pending natural eye lubricant to provide relief for dry eye sufferers, an exciting new procedure to unblock obstructed tear glands, and a topical cure for eye surface cancer. Dr. Maskin has been successfully managing difficult dry eye cases for over 20 years and is board-certified, fellowship-trained, and a fellow of the American College of Surgeons and American Academy of Ophthalmology. He's been selected a best doctor in America every year from 2000 through 2009 and as an America's top ophthalmologist by Consumers Research Council of America. We hope the Focus on Females education programs, including this show, will help you and your family find the health care that works for you. Focus on Females believes in saving lives and protecting families. And please, visit drmaskin.com, and if you have not found relief for your painful red dry eyes, come in to see Dr. Maskin at the Dry Eye and Cornea Treatment Center, where comfortable eyes lead to restored lives.
Foreclosure, divorce, business conflicts, you need to know your options, and we're here to help. I'm attorney Hunter Chamberlain of the Tampa law firm Chamberlain Patrick. Whether it's your home or business, your marriage, or you or a family member has been accused of a crime, having an experienced attorney on the case early can maximize your chances for a good outcome. Call Chamberlain Patrick today at 813-374-2216. That's 813-374-2216. Chamberlain Patrick, your business, your family, your home.
Studio lines are open, so get focused, get involved, and get the advice you need for your health. In Hillsboro, 289-1860, and everywhere else, 877-969-8600. Once again, our host for the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic, Dr. Stephen Maskin.
And welcome back to the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic. Today we're discussing gastric ulcers and NSAIDs, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, with guest expert Dr. Jürgen Nord of the College of Medicine at the University of South Florida. And we've discussed a lot already about this issue, including H. pylori, including risk factors, the scope of NSAID use in the United States, hospitalizations and deaths from NSAID use, and so forth. Let's talk about a different type of NSAID that we've been talking, generally speaking, about, and that's the COXIBs, for example, the Celebrex drug. Is that considered a safer or better than the non-selective NSAID?
Yes. We used to have more than one. Now we have only Celebrex left after Bextra and Vioxx have been taken off the market. And they came out as initially super NSAIDs or safer NSAIDs. They are not necessarily super NSAIDs because they don't have a higher pain or fever control, but they are clearly safer because they do not block the protective agents in the stomach, and therefore the overall risk is reduced by about 50%.
Wow.
That is true for about, if you take it regularly, for about 6 months, but after a year or 2 years, clearly the lines come together and then the complication rates are identical to what we call the non-selective NSAIDs.
and it has the other risk factors or the effect on the small intestine, the kidney blood flow, and other systemic?
Yes, they are lesser as well. So no question about it. But as you well know, there's a real concern about cardiac safety, and even Celebrex has some issues there. It has been kept on the market because the risks were lower than with Vioxx, for instance, but patients who have significant heart disease and are on Celebrex certainly should discuss that with their physicians, especially with their cardiologists.
Very good. Okay, so let's say we have a gastric ulcer, or at least we know we're going to be taking this drug for a significant amount of time, and therefore we want to think about how to protect the stomach from developing an ulcer. What drugs are available for so-called gastroprotection?
The drugs, Stephen, are primarily the acid-blocking medications. And let me go back again. Obviously, we cannot prescribe this, or not everybody who takes NSAID should take it. But if you look again at the high-risk individuals, those that have had an ulcer or bleeding ulcer before, individuals who have had or who take multiple NSAIDs, high NSAIDs, or a combination with an anticoagulant, those that are 65, 70 and older, certainly should be on these drugs, and that's actually FDA-approved indication and therefore should be paid by the insurance company. The most effective drugs are what's called a class of PPIs, or proton pump inhibitors. And let me just throw out some names out there. That would be omeprazole, which is the first one that came about, Prilosec, which is now available not only in generic form but without prescription over the counter, Nexium, a sister to Prilosec, Prevacid, also now available over the counter, Protonix, available as a generic form and therefore affects overall, you know, cost of the prescription, and Acifex, as well as Zegaret, which is omeprazole, as well as an acid. So these are the drugs that we should use, and these drugs don't reduce that risk to zero, but they reduce it by about 50%, which is a major gain.
So if you're taking a proton pump inhibitor and you are on Celebrex, and that's significant reduction in your risk factors.
That is correct. It would reduce that. It would cut that risk basically in half.
And tell me your view on generics. As far as, are they as effective in regard to the PPIs, the proton pump inhibitors?
Yes, I think generics are really a great addition, and especially in the state of Florida, if not specified, if a generic is available, it should always be prescribed because it is less expensive. Question is, are they equally safe? Are they equally effective? And I think that's true for the majority of these drugs, and we have no reason to assume that they are not. Furthermore, the question comes up, well, I have been on this drug for an extended period of time, do they lose their efficacy? And they do not, and therefore they are as effective now as compared to 10 years ago when we first started it, for instance. Maybe I should make one more point. How should you take these drugs? And I always ask my patients, how do you take it with reference to the meals? Some, well, I take it, you know, with all my other medications, you know, during breakfast or after breakfast. And the most effective way for these drugs to work is if you take it 20 to 30 minutes before you eat breakfast. And the reason for that is that these are drugs that are at that time, then when you eat your meal, in the bloodstream, and the meal stimulates the stomach and the pumps that make acid, and they attach themselves to the activated pump. So very important, if you take it in the morning, take it before your first meal. Hopefully that's breakfast. In the evening, take it before dinner, not at bedtime.
Are these usually acute, once a day?
Once a day is sufficient, absolutely. Once a day. These drugs are not inexpensive, and therefore certainly no need to take it twice a day. Another question you might ask, what about the H2 receptor antagonist, and that would be Tagamet, Zantac, Pepcid, and these kind of drugs? In some studies, they have been shown to reduce ulcers as well, so they could be taken, and they are much less expensive, but they have not been shown to prevent some of the complications, especially bleeding. So therefore, if you have the choice, I think a proton pump inhibitor, hopefully, you know, a generic over-the-counter would be your safest bet. But again, discuss it with your physician.
You mentioned that these proton pump inhibitors do not lose efficacy over the long haul. Correct. Many years.
Correct.
What's the possibility or a frequency of being able to reduce the dosage over time?
That's a good point, and you can do that if you suffer from gastroesophageal reflux disease or GERD, and you should really titrate it to control of symptoms. If you talk about gastroprotection in somebody who is at high risk to get into trouble or was in trouble before with NSAIDs, I would not reduce the dose. I would take Prilosec or any of the other medications on a regular basis, meaning once a day.
Mm-hmm. And how about the consideration of reducing the dose of the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory agent?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you think about a possible effect on renal blood flow, on other issues, depending what you take it for, if you take it for arthritis, see if there are some alternatives, or, take the lowest effective dose, as I said before, the shortest period of time.
So if you've been taking it, say, obviously two times or two pills four times a day,
yeah,
then you consider dropping to one. But how about if you've been taking it just, one pill two or three times a day, how about breaking out the pill cutter and see if a half a pill can do the job?
It might very well do that because it depends on the severity of your symptoms. Also be aware that, we mentioned just three pharmacological names, ibuprofen, naproxen, and diclofenac. These are available under trade names, just multiple ones, and it's literally hundreds of those. And therefore, please read the label and see what's in it, because you may not be aware. I recently had a patient where I was very concerned that this was related to non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs.
She
came with pain and an ulcer and said, no, I don't take any aspirin, I don't take ibuprofen, I don't take any of those. We talked to the mother, my fellow talked to her. And then as I called her back several days later, she said, I never told you I had some trouble with my shoulder and I took a drug called Mobic, clearly one of the NSAIDs. That was the answer.
So I guess the point here for the listeners is that many of us take medications because we know that it has an analgesic effect without necessarily realizing that it is falls into the class of drugs known as an NSAID with the attendant risk of stomach ulcer.
Right. Read the label, know what's in it, and follow the instructions with reference to dosage.
How about some of the supplements that people are taking these days, the herbal supplements, some of the other drugs? I don't want to call them drugs, but they are supplements that have not been reviewed by the FDA. Anything stands out in your mind as something that could increase the risk of ulceration?
Not that I know of, but as you correctly pointed out, these drugs or these substances are not subject to tight FDA regulation, and therefore many of the claims don't necessarily have to be substantiated. I just want to make one point about vitamin E, which, if taken in somewhat higher dosages, can lead to bleeding, and so I would be very careful with that, certainly prior to, let's say, dental surgery, general surgery, other situations.
How about other antioxidants? Any risk factors with other?
No, not necessarily, but certainly let's take vitamin C, an antioxidant. That's ascorbic acid, and that locally can affect your stomach and can cause erosions, can cause stomach pain, even ulcerations, because it is an acid. Many times it's taken in doses far in excess of what is appropriate. Your body needs maybe about 60 milligrams, and people take a gram, 3 grams, 5 grams. Most of it is excreted in the kidney. As it gets warmer, it can lead to kidney stones, as we may not be as hydrated as we should be, and can lead to calcium oxalate stones.
Okay. All right. And tell me, any comment on the omega-3 fatty acids as far as its impact on the stomach lining? Very popular these days. Everyone's taking flax oil, fish oils, and so forth.
Right. Not that I know of. It would be very neutral, I would think. And those would be probably, beneficial. Again, they are most effective in their natural form. So if you take, for instance, walnuts, almonds, and so forth, or eat, quote-unquote, fatty fish, from cold waters, that would probably be better than taking it in form of capsules.
All right. Is there anything that we could take from a nutrition perspective that actually can enhance the strength of our stomach lining?
No, we cannot. That's internally regulated, and of course our stomach is designed to accept a variety of foods, and you always think that whatever malady we might have, if it's affecting our intestinal tract, it's related to what we put in there. And unfortunately, that's not the case. Many times patients with inflammatory bowel disease, for instance, say, well, you know, should I be on a special diet for that? Should I be on an ulcer diet? So that would be very appropriate here. And in the old days, the ulcer diet was kind of bland and white and liquid, kind of like the white blanket of love, so to speak, you put over it. No, it makes no difference whatsoever.
So there's no such thing as an ulcer diet anymore?
No. Also, stress is not, you know, it's not your body. It's not stress, except if your boss or stress is either Helicobacter pylori or an NSAID. It's very simple these days. Ulcers are caused by two things, either Helicobacter pylori, NSAIDs, or a combination of the two.
Okay, so we can't blame a third party.
No, I mean, dyspepsia, your stomach might get in knots. I say, my stomach is in knots. I put you under stress. And today, especially in the present economic climate, life is very, very stressful. So the stomach is a frequent target organ, but stress does not cause ulcers.
Very important. Okay, so in summary, coming to a conclusion, what are, for example, maybe three closing points you'd like to share with our listeners?
NSAIDs are widely used. They are very common, very effective drugs. They can have significant side effects in a small number of patients, and I talked about it repeatedly, those patients that are in the high-risk category, those that have problems before, high doses, multiple NSAIDs, anticoagulations, and so forth. We have ways to reduce that risk, primarily by using an acid-blocking medication called a proton pump inhibitor, and that reduces that risk by about 50%. It also decreases the pain associated with it. Otherwise, be vigilant. If you take, for instance, low-dose aspirin, know what your risk is and know if it benefits you or if you trade it for some complications. Read the labels, use the lowest effective dose, and use it for the shortest period of time.
Excellent. All right, I'd like to thank my guest expert, Dr. Jürgen Nord, as we're wrapping up today's session on gastric ulcers. And for those of you who stay with us week after week, let me give you an update on future topics. Next Sunday, we're going to be tackling optic neuritis with Dr. Mitchell Drucker. And following, that would be, let's see, next, that would be February 7th. February 14th, we'll be tackling hormone replacement therapy in menopause with Dr. Carol Cox. February 21st, eating disorders with Dr. Pauline Powers. February 28th, infections from pets with Dr. Richard Eller. And we may be... Dr. Nord may be back on March the 7th tackling colon cancer. We'll find out later this week. And then the following week, March 14th, kidney stones with Dr. Lopez de Valle, and March 21st, lymphoma with Dr. Sotomayor. And I just booked another show the following week on myeloma with Dr. Alcina from Moffitt Cancer Institute. All right, so I'd like to thank everyone who has joined us today and remind you again to go on our website, focusonfemales.com, to register for the fifth annual Focus on Females Women's Health Symposium. Our keynote speaker this year is Dr. Judy Genshef, USF President. Our honorary chair and MC is Stacey Scheibel, who we all know from News Channel 8, who's their news anchor there. And once again, have a great week, and we'll see you next Sunday on the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic. Bye-bye.
The Focus on Females Healthcare Education programs are for you. Visit our free 5th Annual Focus on Females Women's Healthcare Symposium, March 27th, 2010, at the Tampa Convention Center, and every Sunday from 1 to 2 p.m. for the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic on Talk Radio 860 WGUL.